This is the People's Game for June 24th, the 14th day of the 2010 World Cup Finals in South Africa. The big news of the day, of course, is the defeat of the Azzurri. The defending World Cup champions are out of the tournament. The other big news of the day are Japan knocking out Denmark in a showdown matchup that sends Japan through into the second round and the Danes go home. As for the Azzurri, all my friends are calling me up and saying, "Damn, Alan, your team's out. You must be feeling wretched," and you can feel the sympathy in their voices. Well, I didn't really feel like I needed any sympathy. I thought no way this side was going to compete. I thought the team selections were wretched to the point of corruption, and we'll be talking about that both with Alexander Stiele and a little bit with our first guest today, Harry Brown. With Harry Brown, we'll be discussing really the central theme of this radio show, the question of whether left politics fits with global soccer. We all know that left politics and working class solidarity and anti-colonialist solidarity certainly resonated with soccer in previous decades. But now that the game is so globalized, such a high-tech spectacle, in what way does it work with the left? Does it work against people's struggle, or can it again be reclaimed for people's struggles? And then we're joined by Alexander Stiele. He himself, not a soccer journalist, but really the most eloquent English language reporter I know on Silvio Berlusconi's Italy. And he certainly recognizes that part of the problem with the Azzurri this year is part of the problem with Berlusconi's Italy. And we'll look into that with Alexander Stiele later in the show. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky. Stay tuned. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Harry Brown, who lectures in the School of Media at Dublin Institute of Technology and is author of Counterpunch's Hammered by the Irish, and he is publishing articles about the World Cup on counterpunch.org. Welcome to The People's Game, Harry Brown.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Well, I love your essays, and I'm going to be talking with you about your take on the World Cup in this kind of macro-political manner that you do and we do as well here on The People's Game, but I also gather you're quite a football fan, so I want to ask you right off the bat, you know, this way we can sort of, win the ears of the people who are tuning in to catch all the analysis of the football on the pitch. What do you make of the tournament so far? Who do you like? A lot of big sides have fallen, some surprises. What do you think of it all?
Well, you know, I'm here in Ireland, and obviously we were left out of the tournament in controversial circumstances, so watching the French has been sort of dismally intriguing from an Irish standpoint. Also, my middle name is Mario, so I had a bit of a kick in the teeth today when Italy went out. Who I like, Argentina, and I think Argentina clearly are shaping up as the people's team in this tournament. If my inbox is anything to go by, between Maradona and Messi and the kind of leftist iconography that surrounds the team to some extent, I saw a picture of them online today with a banner on behalf of the grannies of the Plaza del Mayo. And just leaving the politics out for a moment, their football has been mostly splendid. And so I'm quite excited by them. Actually, Japan today were really very good. And Honda's setting up of the third goal was one of these beautiful, beautiful moments of individual skill and then selflessness in passing for his teammate to score that really makes watching football at any level, whether it's in your local park or in the World Cup, just such a joy. And so although the a lot of the games have been dominated by this sort of counterattack, sit back and wait for the other team to come on to you and then hit them with long balls like what Denmark did to Cameroon the other night and they weren't able to do to Japan today. Nonetheless, I have just been completely absorbed in it, 6 hours a day, as my wife will tell you, occasionally pausing to read the child a bedtime story and putting the DVR on pause so that I can run upstairs and fast forward and catch up with the game again. But I think that if I was going to pick a winner, I would certainly say Brazil. Because they have the best defense, and I think that will ultimately tell in the as the tournament wears on.
Well, you know, that's it's interesting to hear you say that about Argentina. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles, and so I'm in Greater Mexico, especially in terms of
what an exciting prospect that is, because Mexico have been very attractive. I mean, they've been one of the teams that's been willing to put four or five players in and around the opposition penalty area. Certainly, they were against South Africa and were very unlucky not to win that game. So I don't think they've got quite the cleverness that the four or five attacking players for Argentina have. But certainly, I think the Argentine defense is suspect, and Mexico may be able to test that. I just can't see them keeping Argentina's own scoreline down sufficiently to get past them.
You mentioned Italy. You mentioned that you're upset by their defeat. I have been a lifelong fan of the Azzurri. I was not in the least upset by their defeat. I was appalled at Lippi's team selection, and I think this is just all of that coming home to roost, because if you're a defender and you're thinking about facing Cassano, Totti, Rossi, who's half American, or even Luca Toni, You have to think about it. You have to contend with it, right? The people that he selected for the front line, they're non-entities if you're an opposition defense going into the match.
It was an extraordinary selection, and so I sympathize with your Lippi had it coming analysis, and you know, this clearly is an Italian team that needs to move on to a new cycle of management and of selection. But given my own heritage, I can't treat it quite as a quite with the distance that you've managed to attach to it. I'm more than a fan of the Azzurri. I'm the grandson of an Italian footballer.
Likewise, I lived in Italy 78 and 79. They won the next World Cup with the generation of players that I learned and loved and embraced. I was a football player myself. I played in Italy, not at the professional level, but in basically the equivalent of high school. It absolutely courses through my blood. I root for them as I watch them today. But 2006 was such a joyous epiphany for me that, in a sense, I've been sated as a sports fan. And I couldn't embrace this team. I couldn't get myself to. And lastly, I'm an AS Roma fan. Totti is my favorite player, bar none.
Oh, yeah. So for Totti not to be there, and obviously it was a hard season for a Roma fan anyway, the way that it ended. So in a sense, that's your Italian football fix. So your addiction is cured for the moment anyway.
Also, for what it's worth too, I mean, this will go right now into politics and football. As much as the center left in Italy is absolutely a pathetic thing, the fact that Berlusconi actually was not prime minister when they won in 2006 made it easier for me to cheer for them as well, because that bastard just wraps himself up in the team like no politician actively doing so, like no other politician in the world pretty much at this moment. And so, you know, again, another silver lining to, yes, I wish they had advanced to then get slaughtered by the Dutch in the next round. But lastly, mercifully, they're gone. And sorry, just one more thing. This is American radio, right? I get to blather on like a fool. That's the whole style of the genre these days. And, you know, I get to say I told you so, as I've been saying for days on this show. They're a wretched team. And they deserve to finish last in a group with New Zealand. I'm sorry to bring you more pain, sir.
All right. I'll get over it.
Anti-imperialism 101, World Cup 2010 by Harry Brown is an article on Counterpunch. And again, I think I have a lot of the same thinking here. USA just played Algeria, and we spoke to somebody on the People's Game. And in Algeria, you write about this in terms of them about to face England and watching the Battle of Algiers. We spoke to Hamoud Salih, an Algerian, about the Algerian press in advance of the match against USA, and just absolutely, this is for the Middle East. It is for the Arab world. It is, if the paper was Islamically oriented, for Muslims around the world versus the imperialist dominator, the United States of America. All of that was brought out. Now the USA.
The American soccer team's not much of a face of American imperialism in a sense. It's one of the things that I've been trying to develop in the articles that I'm writing, is that attempts by people from whatever political persuasion to force a kind of an identity between the state, the society, the government, and the national soccer team are always you know, at best crude approximations of reality, and they're sometimes quite sharp distortions of reality. But certainly it was clear that the Algerian team management felt that they could motivate their players, even though their players, you know, 17 of the 23-man squad were French-born people who obviously needed to learn their Algerian nationalism, and to some extent even their Arab nationalism, their Muslim politics. So it is it's an intriguing situation that the team was really asked to serve this extraordinary proxy role for a whole world of kind of resistance to imperialism. But it also make you wonder why it was that they were so shy about actually trying to score any goals.
Yes,
because as I wrote about in that article, during the time of the original resistance struggle in Algeria in the 1950s, the Liberation Front, the FLN, established a national Algerian soccer team that obviously wasn't able to join FIFA, but it did play friendlies, particularly in Eastern Europe and across the Arab world, and they were notorious for scoring 4, 5, 6 goals a game. The Algerians have gone through this tournament, I think I'm right in saying they didn't score at all, right?
Gave up only 2 goals. One, of course, a big blunder by the goaltender that set that whole group askew, with Slovenia picking up 3 points due to that. And then one by Landon Donovan in, of course, added time of their third match. So they almost pulled off 0-0 for 3 matches. And really very rarely came close at all to scoring a goal. USA, of course, now faces much the same framing, though I doubt the Ghana team will be encouraged to watch
any equivalent to maybe the Spike Lee's Malcolm X or something.
Or Nkrumah, old pan-nationalist speeches by Nkrumah.
Right. Because I mean, Ghana, like Algeria, used soccer in the 50s and 60s very, very much as a symbol of nationalism, but also in the case of Ghana, very much of pan-African identity. It was, the name of the team, the Black Stars, comes from the Marcus Garvey Black Star line that was going to repatriate African Americans to Africa. And so there is a very interesting framing there, but I suspect that the Ghanaian team won't be asked to sort of adopt an anti-American posture, as it were. I think that the kind of links between West Africa and the United States, and even the number of Ghanaians who have managed to make it to the United States in the last 20 or 30 years, will mean that there's a less hostile, less politically hostile environment in that game than there might otherwise be. I don't know. What do you think about it?
Well, I think what is true is that there'll be many people around the world. Nonetheless, I agree with what you're saying. In no way do I expect Ghana and the players on the team and the management to adopt some of the attitude that the Algerians did. And by the way, for what it's worth, I think that kind of mixing of political passion and soccer is brilliant, and I applaud the Argentinian team. Of course, I applaud it when it, humanist and for social well, humanist and for social justice, because I'm certainly not a Muslim nationalist, but at the same time, I am an anti-imperialist. So I can applaud that. Nonetheless, I, like so many of my leftist friends here, and you mentioned this in the article, we found ourselves for the first times in our lives, and clearly I've been an Azzurri partisan, and I've never really had to take seriously Team USA going deep into the tournament, but for the first time, we were absolutely floored by the resolution of that game, and whether we even went into that third match thinking that we were partisans for Team USA, by the end of it, we were.
You certainly were, and I think that's fine.
Yeah.
It's normal, but what about the Ghanaian thing does throw up another another interesting because here we are in West Africa, the match is obviously in South Africa, but we're dealing with a West African team, the region where so many slaves were brought from to build North American prosperity on their blood and their backs. How do we deal with that as a concept, and do we have to? I mean, is it really necessary to approach every soccer game with all of the history and politics that might accrue between the two nations whose names are attached to these teams. I don't know. Obviously, we can't avoid that. But at the same time, you know, I do like to talk about the football. And I do like to, you know, and I think one of the things that happens in the World Cup is that, of course, you come with a lot of political baggage to each team, but then you watch. And one reason that Argentina went from being a team that, you know, one might have sympathy with to being a team that I think has won the world's love is because of the way they've played in the first three games. And, you know, Ghana, to some extent, have been sort of the opposite. You might have had an enormous sympathy for them to begin with as one of the very poorest countries in the tournament, a country with this fascinating history and this very important heritage in terms of the development of football in Black Africa. But their football, although some individuals have been very impressive, their football has, for the most part, been pretty sterile. And I think, you know, that what's fascinating about the World Cup for me is the way that our sort of global politics mixes with our kind of aesthetic politics, and that I think most of us on the left who are interested in soccer tend to want to see the game played beautifully. I think most fans of whatever political persuasion do, but I think there's a particular kind of leftist romanticism about the beautiful game that that Ghana certainly to date have not exactly touched.
It is interesting, too, there, because one would think that if there are people who like the more disciplined approach, who, for instance, within the Brazilian tradition are loving what Dunga's doing and having a less creative, less flair, more disciplined approach to the Brazilian national side, would, you know, have sort of a militaristic approach to this kind of group action. And it's the left that, you know, you see, like in Eduardo Galeano's writings, a real cherishing of the individual flair. And the lack of the authoritarian top-down cohesion.
That's right. I mean, and historically, that hasn't always been the case. I mean, I think certainly some of the Argentine coaches who developed some of the most kind of anti-football in the 60s were not necessarily on the political right. But from reading David Goldblatt's extraordinary history of global football, The Ball is Round, you do get the sense that certainly in Brazil from the 70s on, the kind of, what do they call it, football força, was a kind of a militarist coloring of the Brazilian tradition to emphasize athleticism, you know, physical power, organization, discipline, etc. And you know, and what we're looking at in the certainly in the Brazilian team at the moment is a version of that kind of Brazilian game. At the same time, we're also seeing some really astonishingly good players. It seems to me that the right back, Maicon, must be one of the most magnificent players ever to take that position on a football pitch. Kaká began to come onto his game the other night. Fabiano is clearly, you know, even if he needs to use his arms to score occasionally, is a striker of enormous power and class. Mm. So, but in any case, I think that Ghana, Brazil, these countries allow us, and the World Cup is sort of carnivalesque in this way. It allows us to treat our politics as though it has to do with 22 men running around a field of grass, kicking a little ball, and yet we can still talk about the Battle of Algiers as though it's relevant to that process.
Right. No, and with the United States Ghana match, you know, USA again, the sole superpower, the significant imperialist force within the world. And here, myself and this group of leftist soccer fans that I'm networked with in Southern California, across the country, you know, to keep it within the United States, with Americans, we're starting to embrace. And lo and behold, they get the last African side standing in the second round. They draw that team in the first World Cup held in Africa. So that question really does arise and sort of does pull at the heart to be, here we are, we're really going to be the global bad guys. And how do we feel about that?
But I think that the performance of the African teams at the World Cup should help to cure you of over-sentimentalism about your responsibilities to African football.
Right, but that brings you to your earlier article on Counterpunch, which is that there are sort of institutional structural reasons really beyond the control of the players that bring this about? Because, I mean, you look at the top European leagues and you look at the top teams in the top European leagues, and they have some of their absolutely biggest stars on the top teams are from African nations. And then on top of that, there are African-British, African-French players that are top players for those national sides.
Assimilated, as it were, and who, right. who are taking on the nationalities of the European countries. Absolutely. I mean, it is undoubtedly the case that Africans are some of the best footballers in the world at the moment. I think I mentioned that the FA Cup final in England, which pitted the best team in England, Chelsea, against, you know, a lesser side, Portsmouth. But there were at least seven, may even have been eight, African internationals playing in that game. It really was a extraordinary, you know, it was Algerians and Ivoirians and Senegalese, and so that we need to ask about the process by which those players are coming from Africa, about the series of kickbacks and structures that bring players to Europe and in many cases sort of dump them in Europe. But there's no doubt that about the excellence of African players. So you come back to questions about the national federations, about I saw quite an interesting discussion on the BBC this evening, in which the Emmanuel Adebayor, the great Togolese striker, was saying that you couldn't really an African team couldn't really have an African coach and national side in West Africa, for example, because an African-based coach would be troubling his European-based players for T-shirts, for money, for gifts. It was an extraordinary comment to make that essentially the privileges that the few dozen very, very successful African-based players enjoy in Europe means that they couldn't return to Africa to be coached by a local. What I think is probably required is for the generation like Adebayor to, when they reach retirement, to go back and coach in those countries. That may be what will bring African football to the next level. But at the moment, there's this belief that you need outsiders who are not so caught up in the corruption of the national federations, who aren't caught up in tribal and religious divisions, that, you know, keeping in mind that so many of these nations are nations only in the sense that they were the borders left by the right. Colonial carve-ups in the throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. So you have a number of really difficult problems that are structurally deep in African football, but that may eventually sort of work themselves out generationally. But at the moment, I seem to be insuperable. I think the USA has a very good chance of beating Ghana. Fortunately or unfortunately, I think that it seems to me that it's quite likely.
Well, that was, of course, the big subject here yesterday was Team USA, how good they are. They certainly are a side with incredible resilience. They had basically two goals taken away from them. If those were added in there, they would have scored six in the group stages, one of the highest total.
To be a defensive team in this tournament, but I don't know, maybe because the defense has proven to be not quite up to the task, it has had to turn into quite an aggressively attacking side, and they certainly have deserved, I think they could arguably be said to have deserved to win every one of those three group games, certainly the ones against Slovenia and Algeria, they deserve to win. And they have been they've mostly been a pleasure to watch. I mean, that striker, Josie Altidore, is an incredible, hard-working, hard-running, trouble for defenders. I mean, if he could actually put the ball in the net, he'd be a hell of a player.
Yeah.
But he really is a. But here in Ireland, I must say, there was a lot of laughter about Landon Donovan's interview after the victory over Algeria, in which Donovan sort of said that this epitomized everything that the American people are about. Mm-hmm. You know, we can moan or we can get on with it,
mm-hmm.
And then he sort of gave a shout out to his ex-wife, which seemed to puzzle a lot of people as well. But this sort of in Europe, we still have a kind of a, and I grew up in the States, but I've been living here for 25 years. We still have a sort of dismissive attitude about the naivete of Americans. If they don't appear naive on the field anymore, at least they still seem rather naive off it, and that gives us the satisfaction of being patronizing about them. So that interview with Donovan was being replayed over and over again on the radio on one of our big sports programs here last night, so that the presenters could have a laugh about it repeatedly.
Harry Brown lectures in the School of Media at Dublin Institute of Technology and is author of Counterpunches Hammered by the Irish, and you can find his writings on the World Cup at counterpunch.org. Harry Brown, what do you think of the English side? You had mentioned that the USA could have won all three matches, but everybody is bemoaning the English side, but they actually got through the group stages giving up. The only goal they gave up was Green's terrible error. So while they are incredibly flat on the offense, and Wayne Rooney seems to have lost himself somehow, I know it's tough to ask somebody who roots for Ireland about England, but it just popped into my mind, and we're talking about the football. But, you know, John Terry's doing something right, because no goals have gone through.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, England is the team that I know best, and we watch those players every week, and certainly they have tended to underperform what we know to be their capacity. I mean, I've had email from somebody complaining that I referred to Wayne Rooney as a great player, and I haven't really been able to have any response to that email yet, because in these three games he has been very far from a great player. Although the Slovenian keeper did make a very good save on Rooney's best chance of the match yesterday. I think that you know, the England team, to some extent, though, show the effect, and this has been a problem for Italy over the years, as I'm sure you would recognize as a Azzurri supporter. They show the effect of having so many of the best players in their league, so many of the creative players in their league, being foreigners.
Right.
So that the England players are used to having quicker thinking, more skillful, more thoughtful footballers around them. You know, Steven Gerrard has Fernando Torres to play off when he's playing for Liverpool. He had Xabi Alonso beside him in the midfield until this past season. You know, he benefits in his club setup, even at a Liverpool team that's in decline, from having really wonderful international footballers around him. And so the English sort of kick and rush tendency in the league has been tempered by the intelligence of some of those players. And then when it's nothing but English players on the team, they're certainly lacking that. I think I said in one of my pieces that you can almost hear their brains creaking into action when they get the ball. And okay, now I've got the ball. Now I've got to think about what to do with it next. And you know, you never see Lionel Messi having to pause to consider his next move. It's there built into his muscle fibers, because he has given so much of his brain over to the instinct of playing football, from playing it creatively, from playing it beautifully from the time he was a small child. So I think I'd be very surprised to see England. I wouldn't be surprised to see them beat Germany, but I would be surprised to see them go any further than that.
And probably face Argentina after that.
Yeah, it'd be likely that they would face Argentina, although you're not allowed to say that as a virtual Mexican there in Los Angeles, presumably.
I've been telling people that so many people are speaking with their hearts around here when they look forward to that match. I mean, it's possible. Mexico's got a lot of skill. Argentina maybe still has in the back of their minds how flat they were in qualifying, but they seem to have gelled. Let's actually switch gears. I really was fascinated. Your take on Diego Maradona as a sort of oppositional radical figure. I'd love to get your reflections on that.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting. And the way that Maradona has played out over the World Cup, I wrote about him a few weeks ago as, you know, an oppositional radical figure, in the sense that he sort of has popped up as an anti-imperialist at various times, you know, doing interviews in which he says he hates the Yankees and everything they stand for, or that he's
sure beside
Castro.
But in a sense, that's almost not as surprising. It would be very surprising if it came from almost anybody else, because he's been consistent in his being a subversive figure in global football
right,
from the beginning,
including as a player,
right.
And that's the fascinating sense that in which the what happens on the pitch connects with and sometimes transcends any words that you might use off the pitch. But I mean, Maradona has also been a tragic figure. I mean, the you know, his difficulties with drugs. My grandfather was Neapolitan, and I have a great love of Napoli. But certainly, you know, the Maradona led Napoli to its most glorious period. But it also, the city of Naples clearly nearly killed him. And so he has been. I think we love him because his not only because of what he says, as in, you know, making statements against imperialism, or as he's been doing during this World Cup, positioning himself against the powers in the game, against Platini and against Beckenbauer and against Pelé. But we love him because of what he's endured. This is the kind of the you know, we as sort of left-wing activists may like to say, you know, he's the friend of Cuba and he's an enemy of imperialism. But for most football fans who are drawn to something about Maradona, it's this sort of tabloid endurance. The thing that is usually most lovable in celebrities is this this capacity to hurt himself again and again and to keep coming back for more. And you know, there's a that kind of beautiful what's going to happen next about Maradona that is romantic in its own way. So I think that and I guess again that's the point that that I'm trying to make in the articles, is that we you know, that in football the anti-imperialism can be you know, a 30-yard chip. You know, it can take the form of a pullback on the touchline. It can take the form of a beautifully weighted pass. It's you know, the teams make their statements. They make their most important statements by the way that they play, and by the victories that they can achieve. Certainly, of course, but also sometimes by the way that they lose too. And you know, in Ireland, we've had to get used to being beautiful losers quite a lot over the years. Sometimes not so beautiful losers, but you know, we like to think we've refined it into quite an art, and that too is part of the romance of anti-imperialism and of left-wing struggle. You know, we don't often come out on the winning side in wars and elections and other conflicts, strikes, etc. But you know, we can. We have our martyrs and we have our heroes, and Maradona fit quite neatly into those categories. You know, I mean, he of course did win the World Cup. He has been the finest in the world, but he also has been at the very bottom of the game, banned from the game that he loved to play, and you know, and worse of life. He's been, you know, his life has been in serious danger because of his addictions and his own self-destructive behavior.
Somewhat of a parallel on the team front is France now, which you wrote about also on Counterpunch. And I'm speaking with Harry Brown, who lectures in the School of Media at Dublin Institute of Technology and is author of Counterpunch's Hammered by the Irish. And he has been writing on the World Cup on counterpunch.org. And your most recent article was about what transpired with the French national team. And, of course, France won in 98, out in the first round 2002. Got to the finals and dramatically lost to the Italians in 2006 and are out in the first round in 2010, famously with the team imploding on itself. You, however, saw it was a show of solidarity that you focused upon among the French players.
I guess I have really loved the French team over the last 15 years. Actually, most people in Ireland have. Henri is probably more admired in this part of the world than he is in France, in Britain and in Ireland, because of the great years that he had at Arsenal. I mean, Henri not only put us out of this World Cup with the handball and the qualifying game in November, he put us out of the previous World Cup with a magnificent goal from 30 yards in Dublin. I remember I was sitting just immediately behind him as he was taking the shot, and I said, "Oh no, that's going into the top corner." So he and the French team have been. Although, you know, obviously as a half Italian, I was supporting Italy in the 2006 final. I was still attracted, obviously, to the great players in that French team. And as you've suggested, it's been quite a roller coaster for France over the last 12 years, from 98 and 2000, the heights of those two championships, then to the terrible performances before the 2006 resurgence. So, you know, if the French people actually really, really were football fans, they would have had a hell of a ride for the last 12 years. But I think one of the things that you can see in the response to the way the French team has imploded is that an awful lot of the French have used football as a kind of a convenient ball to kick for their own political purposes, whether it was to oppose or promote multiculturalism or to oppose or promote kind of this team solidarity that was been shown in support of their teammate Anelka in this particular controversy, that in France, particularly for the French elite, they don't have a great feeling for the game. You know, the national sport in France is cycling. The great sport of the Southwest and to some extent of the Parisian middle class is rugby. So that soccer has been a kind of a political football there to a huge extent for this entire period. So it's not terribly surprising that it has kind of culminated in this great national outburst of madness over what I believe is, as you suggest in your question, a rather admirable act of solidarity among the players at the end of the tenure of this absolutely execrable manager, Raymond Domenech. I think that the players needed for their own dignity, finally, to stand up to the federation and to their coach. It may be regarded as tragic for them that they did it in the context of collapsing in the World Cup finals, but it had to happen sometime, and being French, it happened very dramatically in the most public possible way, and I have renewed my affection for them, I must say, as a result of that. I mean, many of those players obviously won't play again for France, and there's new management coming in, and I think we'll see France again. I mean, you know, even going back before 98, there were so many great French teams in the going back to the 50s and then again in the 80s, you know, operating at the kind of periphery of French sporting life, but still producing wonderful football. And I think they'll do it again. I was glad to see them go out of the World Cup, but I was also glad to see them showing that kind of resistance and as a group of players. Although Henri, I think, slightly spoiled it because I believe he flew home on his own a day ahead of the rest of the team and looked for a private meeting with Sarkozy yesterday. As far as I heard, he got onto his private jet and phoned Sarkozy immediately. So that spoils him further for me a little bit. But in general, I thought it was rather heroic in a funny sort of way that the French went out fighting with their management in a way that they probably should have been doing for the last 6 years. I mean, I think most people who watch the French team closely reckon that they got to the final in 2006 because the players started to ignore Domenech and organized themselves around Zidane as the main tactical figure. And that the success in that tournament was in spite of the team management rather than because of it. So it was a rebellion that was a long time coming. But it wasn't a bad way to. It wasn't a bad way for them to go. A kind of a very public suicide, assisted by the Mexicans, Uruguayans, and South Africans.
If only the Italians had shown anything as such spirit as that. They showed a little bit in the last 10 minutes of the match today. I want to shift gears here really dramatically here. You're in Ireland. Ireland was, in this decade, the boom economy, one of the great boom economies of the world, and it came a-crumbling down. Ireland now, where is the general state of the Irish national economy? How tough are things there in the wake of the global financial collapse?
They're absolutely desperate. They're terrible.
How good were they being? How good were they being?
We really could have done with a good World Cup in order to take our minds off the troubles here.
Well, we may still have one yet, but what? For Ireland we shan't, but perhaps for the world.
Yeah, we could have, yeah, we would love to be going into the next round of the World Cup now. But the you know, we're being told at the moment that there are signs of uptick again in the Irish economy, not all the way to a level of growth that would actually have much impact on jobs, etc. But
oddly, we're being told the same thing here.
Yeah, there you go. We haven't actually seen it yet, and certainly, I mean, I work in the public sector, and the government here has taken a much harder kind of neoliberal, let's cut public services line on how to address the crisis. In other words, we haven't gone into the same level of deficit spending that the U.S. government was willing to do, and that the previous British government was willing to do. I mean, our deficits are still pretty high, but our level of debt is very low because of the boom that we did have over the last 15 years. So we've got a situation where European policy and Irish government policy is working to ensure that the hole that we're in is even deeper, and that and because of the particular sins of the Irish financial sector, which was you know, one of the most deeply corrupt in the entire Western world. It was Ireland was at one point the site of a location for 30% of the world's hedge funds. The financial industry was completely caught up in a vast speculative bubble, particularly on property here in Ireland. So what money there is in the national coffers is basically going to bail out the financial system. Again, that may be slightly familiar to American listeners. It is an absolutely terrible situation. There's no sign of an election here because no government would dare go to the public any sooner than it absolutely has to in the current circumstances. I think the government parties have something like a 16 or 17% support in the most recent opinion polls, as opposed to about 45% that they had when they got into the current coalition. So it is... you know, it's a desperate situation, and desperate too in the sense that there doesn't appear to be any coherent political movement from the left that is willing to take it on.
In talking about all of this, you know, in talking to all the countries around the world and hearing so many of the same stories, it's odd. A lyric from a song that sticks in my head, it's some recent Bob Dylan song from the past 15 years where he says, you know, whatever spirituality Bob Dylan is buying into as he's inspired to write the lyric, who knows, but he goes, you can't even hear a murmur of a prayer. And this is so frustrating. These countries with great radical left traditions, if you go back 20 years, 30 years, again, when I was in Italy, and again, even through the matrix of soccer, AS Roma, the ultras, they were pretty much reds, you know?
Yeah.
Lazio were fascists, AS Roma were reds. That generation of Roma fans, they would have had solutions to propose to the global economic crisis and the despair that set in. But there's, again, not even a murmur of a prayer, barely a murmur from any kind of radical left that gains any momentum anywhere. So there's just no signs of that, even in Ireland with its great anti-imperialist and left traditions.
That's right. I mean, you know, we were a state that was founded in anti-imperialist rebellion in the early 20th century, in a rebellion in which the labor movement played a very, very important role, although it was quite immediately sidelined once national independence was achieved. And has really, you know, during the period of the boom, so much of the left was essentially co-opted through the sort of corporatism of the what was called the social partnership process, so that trade unions were brought into national wage negotiations and given a kind of a little hand on the levers of power, not a very important one, but enough to feel influential, so that the trade union movement has essentially been, to use that sexist term, emasculated in terms of its capacity to be part of a real fighting opposition. It's not to say there's not plenty of people out there who do have, you know, ideas about what should be done. I see an awful lot of them on Facebook or whatever, but they're not really, you know, on occasions in the last 2 years when people have taken to the streets in large numbers, unfortunately, the trade union leadership or the leadership of the Labour Party has tended to get up on the stage and basically put everyone back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's seems like there is such leadership as there might be is actually part of their program is to keep the masses feeling impotent so that they can return to some form of social partnership where they again get to have a finger on the levers of power.
I joke around and you know, it's just some kind of fantasy because of the football show, but maybe not. You know, again, in my youth, working class solidarity in football in Western Europe, where I was familiar with, I didn't know Eastern Europe, of course, was a real thing. It's just no longer the case that that association is very foregrounded anymore.
Partly it's because of the way the game has been priced out of the reach of working
sure.
class people mm-hmm. in the last 20 years, and then also the way Eastern Europe developed so that the football became a kind of a site for working class divisions and for nationalism of the most virulent sort, and sometimes for racism as well.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have argued in a previous piece that I think that soccer is sometimes exaggerated and overly reviled as a site of racism. It nonetheless has not been the same sort of site of working class solidarity, even at a cultural level, that it was in previous years.
You know, one of the things, I was sort of making these notes in my head, and they're silly notes, I confess, but arguments for socialism. It was the eve of the World Cup, and I'm sitting there thinking, talking with some friends, we're all so excited. We're riveted. This incredible carnival of soccer is about to explode in front of us, and we were so excited just to watch it. I still can get my old decrepit body out on the field and play pretty well myself, too, and that's a source of tremendous joy. Okay, watching soccer, playing soccer, far superior to economic anxiety. Who in the world can't agree with that? You know, so the joy and the love of soccer is a case in point for living outside of economic anxiety if the society can be organized in a way such that any source of joy, of course, but this is, after all, perhaps the most popular source of joy in the world. So maybe there's some little argument there. Maybe it's just silly. I'm not sure. But
I'd love to agree with you. Let's say I agree with you just for the moment.
Oh, okay.
And we can bask in the joy of the beautiful game.
We can bask in the joy of the beautiful game. And economic anxiety sticks with people now for the coming near future, as it seems to be, because I don't think we're going to return back. I mean, I think, you know, how much debt load can people carry? There can only carry so much, and it doesn't seem like modern finance, global capitalism can construct a prosperous middle class without leveraging that kind of debt. So eventually maybe people will roll around to the necessity for class solidarity again. I can only imagine they will. And hopefully, again, football can play something of the role that it once did.
Well, it's not out of the question that football will be forced by the puncturing of the financial bubbles that it's part of. It'll be forced to return to its working class roots. And that even at the highest level, the game may be reclaimed by the people who have been playing it for most of the last century.
Well, of course, there are movements to try to take the top clubs over by the fans in Manchester and in Liverpool. The Bundesliga, by the way, what the clubs are owned, they have to be 50% plus one vote by the fans. I think that's the rule
that's
of
right.
the structure.
Yeah, the models are there. I mean, the PLC model, the corporate model, has not proved successful.
And alienating beyond belief.
In the same way that you know, neoliberalism can now really be looked at as a 30-year experiment gone horribly wrong. The particular emanation of that in football may also come to be seen in the same light. Of course, there are plenty of interests out there who don't want that to happen on either front, on the macro political front or on the in the football.
And those damn bastards own all the essential resources. We got to do something about that too.
That's right.
Hey, Harry Brown, it is delightful to speak with you. And thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game. Harry Brown lectures in the School of Media at Dublin Institute of Technology and is author of Counterpunches, Hammered by the Irish. And you can find his writings on the World Cup at counterpunch.org. Any final thought?
Enjoy the football.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Alexander Stile, who is the San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia. His most recent book is The Sack of Rome, Money Plus Media Plus Celebrity Equals Power Equals Silvio Berlusconi. He's also the author of an excellent book from the 1990s entitled Excellent Cadavers that looked at the role of the mafia in at that point contemporary Italian political scene. And he writes frequently for the New York Review of Books. Alexander Stile, welcome to the People's Game.
Thanks for having me.
Obviously, Italy is at the top of global headlines right now as the defending world champions have crashed out of the 2010 World Cup tournament. When the draw came out a few months ago, Italy was considered very lucky to be in one of the weakest groups, and yet they did not make it past the first round. Now, the reason I want to speak to Alexander Stile about this is because, to my mind, and as I've said many times on this show, I've been a lifelong partisan for the Azzurri, something was askew about the selection of this team, the way the team had its relationship to a lot of other very talented soccer players who were excluded from the squad. And to me, it wasn't a one-to-one parallel with the sort of corruptions of contemporary Italian society, but it seemed to have something of that flavor. Alexander Stile is the English language journalist that I know who writes most eloquently about Silvio Berlusconi's Italy. So, Alexander Stile, have you looked at today's journalism in Italy, and what do you see there in terms of how the Italian press is responding to the defeat of the Azzurri?
Well, it's interesting because although people haven't read into it a kind of national, psychodrama, actually, as the French did, who have chosen to see the poor performance of their team as a kind of reflection of the disunity of a France increasingly multicultural but divided by race, ethnicity, religion. The Italians haven't yet read it in those terms, but it's clear that there are actually outlines of this defeat that do recall a big national problems, in the sense that the problems of this national team do seem to reflect strangely the problems of the country as a whole, in that the man who was called on to coach the team, Marcello Lippi, seems to have sort of acted to kind of defend the status quo. He was a longtime trainer of the Juventus team and chose a very high percentage of Juventus players to the exclusion of many people who that many fans felt were far more deserving. He also was kind of trying to preserve the core of the old team that had won in 2006 rather than renewing the team with fresh blood. And that's actually the kind of problem of the society as a whole. It functions very much as a kind of gerontocracy dominated by a series of powerful figures who kind of protect their fiefdoms and who, in many cases, block advancement, sort of the opposite of a meritocracy. So in some weird way, the failures of this team do seem to reflect the problems of society as a whole. I've written a lot of negative things about Silvio Berlusconi, but I don't think he can be blamed for this particular defeat. It's really a social problem as a whole about the way Italy operates, which is very little transparency, a handful of powerful people who make all the decisions and often make them in self-interested ways.
Actually, I have been surprised by the lack of outrage. Just really, there's been considerable despair over Lippi's choices, but I've been surprised at how much people seem to accept it, because the talent pool, especially of offensive players who was left off the side, is unbelievable. I mean, I would put four or five players easily in Cassano, Francisco Totti, Mario Balotelli, even Luca Toni, as if you're an opposition defender, the four people that I just mentioned, they need to be contended with. They're taken as serious challenges. Nobody in the Italian front line even came close to that as far as defenders preparing for the match. And as you know, in all sports or all competitions, sometimes feints are as important as real effect. So even Toni, who trips over himself, the fact that he does require defenses to gravitate to him opens up space for other players. It was baffling. But again, it did seem, again, like the Italian political culture, it was accepted.
Yeah, well, it was a strangely, that I mean, resignation and acceptance of a kind of unhappy status quo is one of the characteristics of life there right now. and as well as weird resignation about the kind of unmeritocratic, unfair nature and way in which, you know, decisions of advancement are taken. The other thing that is striking, of course, for people who've followed this situation over a period of years is that soccer in Italy has been a big barometer of the way the country as a whole operates. It's become increasingly an important part of Italian life, more so than in past decades, perhaps because of television and the increased televisation of soccer, and it evokes powerful sense of identification among Italians, and that may contribute to the reluctance to criticize too strongly. But it was interesting, the comments that I saw were sort of saying, okay, now it's really time to clean house, and the rhetoric is sort of a little bit like what you hear in the political realm. And it's very striking that in Italy, soccer is one of the few things that really unites the country. In you know, Italy is going through a period of time where northern regions are contesting the control of the central government over the northern regions of the country, and soccer is one of the few moments in which Italians feel fully Italian. The leader of the Northern League, which has sort of sought autonomy from the rest of Italy and even separation from the rest of Italy, had to kind of publicly apologize and say publicly that he hoped that the national team won. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of this strange overlap between politics and soccer there.
And of course, fans of global soccer know that Silvio Berlusconi owns one of the two traditionally leading sides in Italian soccer right now. Inter Milan has done exceptionally well for the past 5 years, but the two truly dynastic clubs are Juventus, again, that Lippi is so closely related to, and AC Milan that Berlusconi owns. So Berlusconi not only has owned, the side, the Italian side that has won the most European championships and won a number of them while Berlusconi was the head of the club, but he actually has named his political party Forza Italia after the national soccer cheer. So there again is this relationship between politics and soccer, especially as it relates to a nationally unified culture, because things are quite fragmented along
the
north and south.
One of the things that gave Berlusconi sort of national name recognition before he entered into politics, being the president of the at that time winningest soccer team in the country, made him a national celebrity and a hugely popular figure, along with being the owner of the three largest private TV stations. But it gave him total name recognition, and one of the things that struck him, Berlusconi, that is, when he would attend soccer matches, sometimes he would bring prominent politicians with him to these soccer matches because they were happy to be, you know, have great seats at an important soccer match. And the crowd would rush toward him, and they'd walk right by these politicians who were the people who were actually running the country, and they would refer to Berlusconi as Mr. President because he was the president of Milan. That to them was a greater honor than being president of the republic or prime minister. And suddenly Berlusconi realized that the popularity that he had amassed through soccer actually gave him political viability. And so when he went about constructing a political party, he used a lot of the rhetoric and the nomenclature of soccer in launching his political career. When he announced that he was running for office, he used the language of sort of entering the pitch, as they would say in England, you know, entering the field, the soccer field. So, and as you mentioned, adopted as his party name the national soccer cheer, and he you know, the Italian soccer team is the Azzurri, the Blues. And you know, his political party are also the Blues, and so it's a weird blending of soccer culture with political culture, but powerful on a popular level.
I'm talking with Alexander Stila here on The People's Game. He is the San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia. His most recent book is The Sack of Rome, Money Plus Media Plus Celebrity Equals Power Equals Silvio Berlusconi. We're talking about Silvio Berlusconi, who's in, what is this, his third time as the head of state in Italy, as the prime minister?
Third time as head of state, and he's been sort of the dominant figure since 1994,
right.
with sometimes out of office, but has been in office more than he's been out.
Well, it was important for me as a traditional fan of the Azzurri, and I know in many respects this is a petty relationship between politics and soccer, but he was not the prime minister. It was Romano Prodi in 2006 when Italy won, and I actually felt better about rooting for Italy at that moment, and clearly that team was going to be competitive in a way that this team was not this year, much stronger side. I felt so much better about rooting for them with Berlusconi out of power because Berlusconi couldn't wrap himself in the success of that. Going back to the 90s, though, I do want to point out again that Berlusconi's teams in AC Milan, they weren't just good. They were really amongst the greatest club sides in the history of the sport. Their success in the early 90s was unbelievable. I mean, it's one of the top five club sides for a stretch of years of any team in the history of the sport. And Fabio Capello, the current manager of England, someone under a lot of fire, was the manager of that side at the time. So 2006, Italy won the World Cup. And again, the absolute explosion of national euphoria was just something that I don't know if people can imagine it if they've never witnessed anything like that. But I was once in northern Italy when they had won a match, just a match in 2002. I think their first match. I was the only time I was ever there for a World Cup match against Ecuador, and the whole city of Bergamo just exploded. People ran out in the street, started kicking soccer balls across the street in this sort of joyous carnival spirit. 2006, it was amazing, and yet they won in 2006 amidst this intense soccer scandal. And for, again, fans of the sport, it was sort of uncanny because the last time they had won the World Cup in 1982, again, Italian soccer was immersed in a terrible scandal. They seem only to be able to win when they're immersed in a scandal.
Well, it's hard to know about that. But what that scandal does show you, which is really, there were a lot of very troubling aspects to it. Some of your listeners may not have followed all the ins and outs of it, but some of the things that came out in the course of these investigations were that particularly some of the most powerful teams had a grip on, some of the empires who officiated matches and managed to get favorable officiating and win some games that they shouldn't have done. And it was obvious that they enjoyed a kind of position of privilege that was, obviously completely improper. The head of Juventus, but when he was questioned, he insisted that Berlusconi's team also, that they were simply playing catch-up because Berlusconi's people had other people in their pocket. But what was very disturbing was the sense that Italian soccer functioned like a lot of other parts of Italian life, which is with corruption and unfairness playing an oversized role, that people didn't really know what to trust because they felt they were always playing with a stacked deck, and it turns out that in many cases there were. I don't know if it's true, but when I was in Perugia a couple of years ago, someone there was telling me that some of the players, took bribes to throw some match, but then the coach had taken a bribe to do it the other way, and so they ended up losing. Even just ordinary fans, these are kind of rumors, but the idea that you don't even know, playing to win or not is a very depressing situation, and it has to eventually kind of trickle down into the way people play, even in international matches like this.
Well, Serie A's status these past few years has declined precipitously versus the Spanish League and the English League. While it's true an Italian side, Inter Milan, won the European Championship with the greatest global coach, Jose Mourinho. Well, he left after he won, number one. Two, while he was at Inter Milan, he actually spoke about how he loved Inter, but was not in love with Italian soccer and didn't seem to care much for Serie A. The stands aren't filled. The spectacle of Italian soccer on the weekends, the stands are filled almost exclusively with men, which is true of most of European soccer, but that's no longer true in, for instance, the British Premiership. It's become a more inviting and less hooliganish environment in England and Spain, whereas Italy is rough. And the league seems to be declining, and again, it seems to parallel a country that seems to have stagnated, to held on to its tradition of corruption, in fact, gripping to it desperately, it seems, in the embracing of Silvio Berlusconi. So I suppose to wrap and to maybe, in a sense, let the soccer element sort of fade into the background, just like the 2010s version of the Azzurri is now fading fast into memory, very unmemorable soccer team. Let me ask you two questions. What do you make in the most sort of macro, I mean, maybe you can't give a 3-minute answer to this, but in the most macro historical sense, the fact that Italy had this great rise of prosperity in the post-war years up through, say, the mid-1980s, the country seems to have stagnated, and part and parcel of that seems almost to be a sort of recommitment to corruption.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one of the things that's very striking, if you look at the economic numbers, Italy was one of the fastest growing countries in the world from the post-World War II period into the 80s and even into the early 90s. Corruption grew a great deal in the 1980s for a bunch of reasons I'll spare you. But a system became entrenched that increasingly, because there wasn't prosecution of corruption, there was no sort of punishment for it, and people became more and more brazen about creating patronage machines that involved a lot of self-enrichment. And then you see growth of Italy drop dramatically in the 1990s. Italy was briefly surpassed England in the early 1990s in terms of the size of its GDP, and it's now 20% smaller than Britain in terms of GDP. And there are a number of things that I think explain it. One, with the creation of the European Union and the dropping of all sorts of tariff barriers, you couldn't really hide anymore. A lot of the inefficiencies of the Italian system were exposed by that. And whereas some European countries that had invested in high-tech industries, the Italians were working in, you know, things like making shoes and furniture and clothes that could be made more cheaply in many cases in Asia. So they were more exposed to competition from Asia. And once they had entered into the European Union, they couldn't devalue it, their currency any longer, which is what Italy did for years. Whenever they got into trouble, they would devalue the lira, which is why if you traveled to Italy before the creation of the euro, you were always dealing in millions of lira instead of hundreds of dollars. And so this was a strategy that boosted exports and made Italian goods cheaper overseas. So those options were taken away by the unification of Europe, and a lot of the problems of the economy were exposed by globalization and the economic unification of Europe. So that's a part of it, and a bigger part of it is that as a society they didn't prepare well for the future. I mean, for example, Italy has one of the lowest percentages of university grads among industrialized countries. Countries like Spain, which started farther behind, it was a dictatorship until the mid-1970s, greatly expanded its university system and now has a higher percentage of its population with university degrees. And Italy, instead, has not done that. It invests very little in research and development. It has a very small percentage of patents and things like that that are kind of indicators of innovation in the society. And in that sense, it to sort of return to where we started, it functions too much like a gerontocracy and too much like a series of sort of feudal networks where a handful of powerful people control a lot of resources and prevent people from entering into their domain and control those fiefdoms in a kind of a top-down way, and it suppresses innovation, suppresses change in society. And so Italy has become a much more stagnant society, and it shows in the economic numbers. And perhaps it's too much to read into a soccer match, but you see some of the same elements, strangely enough, in the way this team was put together and the way it performed.
And then the final question, not immediate, but the near future? How does it look in the near future for Silvio Berlusconi? Is he pretty much locked in the center right, locked in? After all, they control
so much of the
media.
The weird thing is that despite a kind of string of scandals that would have normally knocked five politicians out of office forever, Berlusconi, despite the rather rocky performance of the Italian economy and all this other stuff, is still the strongest leader on the scene. You know, part of the problem of having somebody who controls all the television stations on top of running the government is that there's not that much room for other figures to emerge. And so I wouldn't expect, you know, I've, you know, while being a critic of Berlusconi, have always said, be careful in betting against Berlusconi because he's incredibly powerful and incredibly determined, energetic figure, things that, you know, most people would cause most people to throw in the towel and say, who needs this kind of aggravation? That doesn't work with him. He seems to thrive on crisis and has a kind of penchant for creating crisis. So I don't see that changing. His term would last till 2013, I believe. Mm. I wouldn't hold my breath till then. Then things will get very interesting. I think there will be a desire, since he will be in his, you know, late 70s by then, there will be a desire for renewal, even in the center-right that is dominated by him. And there may be problems before that, because his principal ally within his coalition, a man named Gianfranco Fini, is challenging his leadership to some degree, and there's a big stalemate over there over a wiretapping law, which Berlusconi would like to pass, and which would basically make the publication of wiretaps a criminal offense by newspapers and journalists, and involve putting journalists in prison, in fact, for doing that, because Berlusconi keeps having embarrassing conversations that he's conducted, published in the press, that cause him a lot of aggravation. It's not clear Fini may break with him over this, and this could lead to a government crisis if that does happen. But at the moment, I wouldn't be betting against him.
And I do want to let you go because I have to move on in a second. But Fini comes out of the former fascist party. He, however, has positioned himself in a way where that doesn't taint him as a national politician, or is it just national politics have moved so far that they embrace soft fascists?
You know, Fini, who does have a past as a head of a neo-fascist party where he spent his youth and 30s, has, over the last 15 years, moved very consistently and determinedly toward the center. And there are a lot of people, people that I know who might normally vote center-left, who are, you know, look favorably on Fini because he has taken very moderate positions on a number of positions over a number of years. It doesn't seem to be, a quick temporary change. He's also, you know, gone to a great trouble to reassure the, for example, quite popular in the Jewish community in Italy, small as it is, you know, went to Israel and apologized to Israel over the contribution to fascism, to the Holocaust, and things like that. So it's hard to know whether that's a sincere kind of conversion, but it does seem to be a very consistent one that he's pursued with a lot of determination over the last 10 years, remaking himself politically. And so he may have a role to play in terms of the kind of figure of the center who may be tip Italian politics one way or the other toward the center right, the center left. There are a lot of people in the center left who are kind of privately, playing footsie with Fini and trying to get him to break away from Berlusconi in order to form a different kind of government.
And the legacy of the great Italian post-war left, it's pretty much just consigned to the dustbin of history at this point?
Well, it's It's in very bad shape. I think it's a long discussion, but I think that they, the former communists split at the time, and the majority of the old Communist Party decided to become a kind of social democratic party that's whose positions are, let's say, rather similar to the Democratic Party in this country, quite centrist. But they haven't really figured out how to kind of establish a new identity. And, it's difficult in general in this particular moment in Europe in which you have, governments contemplating major austerity measures and things like that to understand what kind of vision you can give a center-left party that is going to excite people, to have a center-left party that just says, okay, it's time to tighten our belts and raise the retirement age, whereas somebody like Berlusconi says, I'm going to make you all as rich as I am, and we're going to kick all these terrible immigrants out of the country, too. Those are issues that, for better or worse, appeal to something emotional in the electorate, and the left doesn't have a kind of emotional appeal to make to its electorate at the moment. And so I see that as a problem.
Generations of soccer players only have 10-year careers, maybe 15 years at the top, and it seems like the Italians have a lot of players on their national side that were in their 15th or 16th year this year. It'll necessarily have to renew itself, and hopefully that can be the case for Italian politics as well, though that seems like a little bit more of a long shot right now. Alexander Stile, I want to thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game. And Alexander Stile is the Sao Paulo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia. His most recent book is The Sack of Rome, Money Plus Media Plus Celebrity Equals Power Equals Silvio Berlusconi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.